He could remember a time when he would have been swarmed by friends, acquaintances, and yes, even sycophants at a feast like this. Now none approached him, though they gave way before him. Elokar might think his uncle was growing weak, but his reputation quelled most lesser light eyes. He soon approached the bridge to the final island, the King's Island. Pole-mounted gem lamps ringed it, glowing with blue stormlight, and a fire pit dominated the center of the platform. Deep red coals simmered in its bowels, radiating warmth. Elokar sat at his table just behind the fire pit, and several high princes ate with him. Tables along the sides of the platform were occupied by male or female diners, never both at the same time. Wit sat on a raised stool at the end of the bridge leading onto the island. Wit actually dressed as a light eyes should. He wore a stiff black uniform, silver sword at his waist. Dalinar shook his head at the irony. Wit was insulting each person as they stepped onto the island.
"Brightness Marakal, what a disaster that hairstyle is! How brave of you to show it to the world! Bright Lord Marakal, I wish you'd warned us you were going to attend. I'd have forgone supper. I do so hate being sick after a full meal. Bright Lord Catalar, how good it is to see you! Your face reminds me of someone dear to me."
"Really?"
Wizened Catalar said, hesitating.
"Yes," Wit said, waving him on. "My horse. Ah, Bright Lord Neteb, you smell unique today. Did you attack a wet white spine, or did one just sneeze on you? Lady Alamy, no, please, don't speak. It's much easier to maintain my illusions regarding your intelligence that way. And Bright Lord Dalinar."
Wit nodded to Dalinar as he passed.
"Ah, my dear Bright Lord Taselin. Still engaged in your experiment to prove a maximum threshold of human idiocy? Good for you. Very empirical of you."
Dalinar hesitated beside Wit's chair as Taselin waddled by with a huff.
"Wit," Dalinar said, "do you have to?"
"To what, Dalinar?" Wit said, eyes twinkling. "Eyes, hands, or spheres? I'd lend you one of the first, but by definition, a man can only have one eye. And if it is given away, who would be Wit then? I'd lend you one of the second, but I fear my simple hands have been digging in the muck far too often to suit one such as you. And if I gave you one of my spheres, what would I spend the remaining one on? I'm quite attached to both of my spheres, you see."
He hesitated.
"Or, well, you can't see. Would you like to?"
He stood up off his chair and reached for his belt.
"Wit," Dalinar said dryly.
Wit laughed, clapping Dalinar on the arm.
"I'm sorry. This lot brings out the basest humor in me. Perhaps it's that muck I spoke of earlier. I do try so hard to be elevated in my loathing of them, but they make it difficult."
"Care for yourself, Wit," Dalinar said. "This lot won't suffer you forever. I wouldn't see you dead by their knives. I see a fine man within you."
"Yes," Wit said, scanning the platform. "He tasted quite delicious. Dalinar, I fear I'm not the one who needs that warning. Speak your fears at a mirror a few times when you get home tonight. There are rumors about."
"Rumors?"
"Yes, terrible things. Grow on men like warts."
"Tumors?"
"Both. Look, there is talk about you."
"There is always talk about me."
"This is worse than most," Wit said, meeting his eyes. "Did you really speak of abandoning the Vengeance Pact?"
Dalinar took a deep breath.
"That was between me and the King."
"Well, he must have spoken of it to others. This lot are cowards, and no doubt that makes them feel like experts on the subject, for they've certainly been calling you that a great deal lately."
"Stormfather."
"No, I'm Wit. But I understand how easy a mistake that is to make."
"Because you blow so much air," Dalinar growled, "or because you make so much noise?"
A wide smile split Wit's face.
"Why, Dalinar, I'm impressed. Maybe I should make you Wit. Then I could be a high prince instead."
He stopped.
"No, that would be bad. I'd go mad after a mere second of listening to them. then would likely slaughter the lot. Perhaps appoint Kremlings in their places. The kingdom would undoubtedly fare better.
Dalinar turned to go.
Thank you for the warning.
Wit sat back down on his stool as Dalinar walked away.
You're welcome. Ah, Bright Lord Habitab, how thoughtful of you to wear a red shirt with a sunburn like that. If you continue to make my job this easy, I fear my mind shall become as dull as Bright Lord Tumul's. Oh, Bright Lord Tumul, how unexpected it is to see you standing there. I didn't mean to insult your stupidity. Really, it's quite spectacular and worthy of much praise.
Lord Yonatan and Lady Myrev, I'll forego an insult for you this once on account of your recent wedding, though I do find your hat quite impressive, Yonatan. I trust it is convenient to wear on your head something that doubles as a tent at night. Ah, and is that Lady Navani behind you? How long have you been back at the plains, and how did I not notice the smell?
Dalinar froze.
What?
Obviously your own stench overpowered mine, Wit,
a warm feminine voice said.
Has no one done my son a service and assassinated you yet?
No, no assassins yet, Wit said, amused. I guess I've already got too much ass-sass of my own.
Dalinar turned with shock. Navani, the king's mother, was a stately woman with intricately woven black hair. And she was not supposed to be here.
Oh, really, Wit, she said. I thought that kind of humor was beneath you.
So are you,
technically, Wit said, smiling from atop his high-legged stool. She rolled her eyes.
Unfortunately, Brightness, Wit replied with a sigh, I've taken to framing my insults in terms this lot will understand. If it will please you, I shall attempt to improve my diction to more elevated terms.
He paused.
I say, do you know any words that rhyme with biscumber?
Navani just turned her head and looked at Dalinar with a pair of light violet eyes. She wore an elegant dress, its shimmering red surface unbroken by embroidery. The gems in her hair, which was streaked with a few lines of gray, were red as well. The king's mother was known as one of the most beautiful women in Alethkar, though Dalinar had always found that description inadequate. For surely there wasn't a woman on all of Roshar to match her beauty.
Fool,
he thought, tearing his eyes away from her.
Your brother's widow.
With Gavilar dead, Navani was now to be treated as Dalinar's sister. Besides, what of his own wife? Dead these 10 years, wiped by his foolishness from his mind. Even if he couldn't remember her, he should honor her. Why had Navani returned? As women called out greetings to her, Dalinar hurriedly made his way over to the king's table. He sat down. A servant arrived in moments with a plate for him. They knew his preferences. It was steaming peppered chicken, cut in medallions, and laid atop fried round slices of tenem, a soft, light orange vegetable. Dalinar grabbed a piece of flatbread and slipped his dining knife from the sheath on his right calf. So long as he was eating, it would be a breach of etiquette for Navani to approach him. The food was good. It always was at these feasts of Elokar's. In that, the son was like the father. Elokar nodded to Dalinar from the end of the table, then continued his conversation with Sadius. High Prince Royan sat a few seats down from him. Dalinar had an appointment with him in a few days, the first of the high princes he'd approach and try to convince to work with him on a joint plateau assault. No other high princes came to sit near Dalinar. Only they, and people with specific invitations, could sit at the king's table. One man lucky enough to receive such an invitation sat on Elokar's left, obviously uncertain if he should join in the conversation or not. Water gurgled in the stream behind Dalinar. Before him, the festivities continued. It was a time for relaxation, but the Alethi were a reserved people, at least when compared with more passionate folk like the Horn-Eaters or the Reshi. Still, his people seemed to have grown more opulent and self-indulgent since his childhood. Wine flowed freely and foods sizzled fragrantly. On the first island, several young men had stepped into a sparring ring for a friendly duel. Young men at a feast often found reason to remove their coats and show off their swordsmanship. The women were more modest with their displays, but they engaged in them as well. On Dalinar's own island, several women had set up easels where they were sketching, painting, or doing calligraphy. As always, they kept their left hands shrouded in their sleeves, delicately creating art with the right. They sat on high stools, the kind that Wit had been using. In fact, Wit had probably stolen one for his little performance. A few of them attracted creation spren, the tiny shapes rolling across the tops of their easels or tables. Navani had gathered a group of important light-eyed women to a table. A servant passed by in front of Dalinar, bringing the women some food. It appeared to also have been made with the exotic chicken, but had been mixed with steamed methi fruit and covered in a reddish-brown sauce. As a boy, Dalinar had secretly tried women's food out of curiosity. He'd found it distastefully sweet. Navani placed something on her table, a device of polished brass about the size of a fist, with a large infused ruby at its center. The red stormlight lit the entire table, throwing shadows down the white tablecloth. Navani picked up the device, rotating it to show her dinner companions its leg-like protrusions. Turned that way, it looked vaguely crustacean.
"I've never seen a fabrial like that before." Dalinar looked up at her face, admiring the contours of her cheek.
Navani was a renowned artifabrian. Perhaps this device was... Navani glanced at him, and Dalinar froze. She flashed the briefest of smiles at him, covert and knowing, then turned away before he could react.
"Storming woman," he thought,
pointedly turning his attention to his meal. He was hungry and got so involved in his food that he almost didn't notice Adolin approaching. The blonde youth saluted Elokar, then hurried to take one of the vacant seats beside Dalinar.
"Father," Adolin said in a hushed tone, "have you heard what they're saying?"
"About what?"
"About you. I've fought 3 duels so far against men who described you and our house as cowards. They're saying you asked the king to abandon the Vengeance Pact."
Dalinar gripped the table and nearly rose to his feet, but he stopped himself.
"Let them speak if they wish," he said, turning back to his meal, stabbing a chunk of peppered chicken with his knife and raising it to his lips.
"Did you really do it?" Adolin asked. "Is that what you talked about at the meeting with the king 2 days back?"
"It is," Dalinar admitted.
That elicited a groan from Adolin.
"I was worried already when I..."
"Adolin," Dalinar interjected, "do you trust me?"
Adolin looked at him, the youth's eyes wide, honest, but pained.
"I want to, Storm's father. I really want to. What I am doing is important. It must be done."
Adolin leaned in, speaking softly.
"And what if they are delusions? What if you're just getting old?"
It was the first time someone had confronted him with it so directly.
"I would be lying if I didn't admit that I'd considered it, but there was no sense in second-guessing myself. I believe they're real. I feel they're real.
But
this is not the place for this discussion, son," Dalinar said. "We can talk of it later, and I will listen to and consider your objections. I promise."
Adolin drew his lips to a line.
"Very well."
"You are right to be worried for our reputation," Dalinar said, resting an elbow on the table. "I had assumed that Elokar would have the tact to keep our conversation quiet, but I should have asked him to do so directly. You were right about his reaction, by the way. I realized during the conversation he would never retreat, so I changed to another tactic."
"Which is?"
"Winning the war," Dalinar said firmly. "No more scuffling over gem hearts, no more patient, indefinite siege. We find a way to lure a large number of Parshendi onto the plains, then execute an ambush. If we can kill a large enough number of them, we destroy their capacity to wage war. Failing that, we find a way to strike at their center and kill or capture their leaders. Even a chasm fiend stops fighting when it's been decapitated. The Vengeance Pact would be fulfilled and we could go home."
Adolin took a long moment considering, then nodded sharply.
All right.
No objections? Dalinar asked. Normally his elder son had plenty.
You just asked me to trust you, Adolin said. Besides, striking harder at the Parshendi? That's a tactic I can get behind. We'll need a good plan, though. A way to counter the very objections you yourself raised 6 years ago.
Dalinar nodded, tapping the table with his finger.
Back then, even I thought of us as separate princedoms. If we had attacked the center individually, each army alone, we'd have been surrounded and destroyed. But if all 10 armies went together, with our soul casters to provide food, with the soldiers carrying portable shelters to set up for high storms, over 150,000 troops, let the Parshendi try to surround us then. With the soul casters, we could even create wood for bridges if we had to.
That would take a lot of trust, Adolin said hesitantly.
He glanced down the high table toward Satius. His expression darkened.
We'd be stuck out there together and isolated for days. If the High Princes started squabbling mid-March, it could be disastrous.
We'll get them to work together first, Dalinar said. We're close. Closer than we've ever been. 6 years and not a single High Prince has allowed his soldiers to skirmish against those of another.
Except back in Alethkar. There, they still fought meaningless battles over land rights or old defenses. It was ridiculous, but stopping the Alethi from warring was like trying to stop the winds from blowing. Adolin was nodding.
It's a good plan, Father. Far better than talk of retreating. They won't like giving up the plateau skirmishes, though. They like the game of it.
I know. But if I can get one or two of them to start pooling soldiers and resources for plateau assaults, it might be a step toward what we'll need for the future. I'd still rather find a way to lure a large force of Parshendi out onto the plains and meet them on one of the larger plateaus, but I haven't yet been able to figure out how to do that. Either way, our separate armies will need to learn to work together.
And what do we do about what people are saying about you?
I'll release an official refutation, Dalinar said. I'll have to be careful not to make it sound like the king was in error, while also explaining the truth.
Adolin sighed.
An official refutation, Father?
Yes.
Why not fight a duel?
Adolin asked, leaning in, sounding eager.
Some stuffy pronouncement may explain your ideas, but it won't make people feel them. Pick someone who is naming you coward, challenge them, and remind everyone what a mistake it is to insult the Blackthorn.
I cannot, Dalinar said. The codes forbid it for one of my stature.
Adolin probably shouldn't be dueling either, but Dalinar had not forced a complete prohibition on him. Dueling was his life. Well, that and the women he courted.
Then charge me with the honor of our house, Adolin said. I'll duel them. I'll face them with plate and blade and show them what your honor means.
That would be the same thing as me doing it, son.
Adolin shook his head, staring at Dalinar. He seemed to be searching for something.
What?
Dalinar asked.
I'm trying to decide, Adolin said. Which one has changed you most? The visions, the codes, or that book? If there's any difference between them.
The codes are separate from the other two, Dalinar said. They are a tradition of old Alethkar.
No, they're related, Father. All three. They're tied together in you somehow.
Dalinar thought on that for a moment. Could the lad have a point?
Have I told you the story of the king carrying the boulder?
Yes, Adolin said.
I have.
Twice. And you made me listen to the passage being read another time.
Oh. Well, in that same section, there's a passage about the nature of forcing people to follow you as opposed to letting them follow you. We do too much forcing in Alethkar. Dueling someone because they claim I'm a coward doesn't change their beliefs. It might stop them from making the claims, but it doesn't change hearts. I know I'm right about this. You'll just have to trust me on this as well.
Adolin sighed, standing.
Well, an official refutation is better than nothing, I guess. At least you haven't given up on defending our honor entirely.
I never will, Dalinar said. I just need to be careful. I cannot afford to divide us any further.
He turned back to his meal, stabbing his last piece of chicken with his knife and shoving it in his mouth.
I'll get back to the other island then, Adolin said.
Wait, is that Aunt Navani?
Dalinar looked up, surprised to see Navani walking toward them. Dalinar glanced at his plate. His food was gone. He'd eaten the last bit without realizing it. He sighed, steeling himself, and rose to greet her.
Mathana,
Dalinar said, bowing and using the formal term for an older sister. Navani was only 3 months his senior, but it was still applicable.
Dalinar,
she said, a faint smile on her lips.
And dear Adolin.
Adolin smiled broadly. He rounded the table and hugged his aunt. She rested her clothed, safe hand on his shoulder, a gesture reserved only for family.
When did you return? Adolin asked, releasing her.
Just this afternoon.
And why did you return? Dalinar asked stiffly. I was under the impression that you were going to aid the Queen in protecting the King's interests in Alethkar.
Oh, Dalinar, Navani said, voice fond. So stiff, as always. Adolin, dear, how goes courtship?
Dalinar snorted.
He continues to change partners like he's in a dance that involves particularly quick music.
Father,
Adolin objected.
Well, good for you, Adolin, Navani said. You're too young to get tied down. The purpose of youth is to experience variety while it is still interesting.
She glanced at Dalinar.
It isn't until we get older that we should be forced to be boring.
Thank you, Aunt, Adolin said with a grin. Excuse me, I need to go tell Renarin that you've returned.
He hurried away, leaving Dalinar standing awkwardly across the table from Navani.
Am I that much of a threat, Dalinar?
Navani asked, raising an eyebrow at him. Dalinar glanced down, realizing that he was still gripping his dining knife, a wide serrated blade that could double as a weapon in a pinch. He let it clatter to the table, then winced at the noise. All of the confidence he'd felt speaking with Adolin seemed gone in a heartbeat.
Compose yourself, he thought. She's just family.
Every time he spoke with Navani, he felt as if he were facing a predator of the most dangerous breed.
Mathana, Dalinar said, realizing they were still standing on opposite sides of the narrow table. Perhaps we should move too.
He trailed off as Navani waved to an attending girl who was barely old enough to wear a woman's sleeve. The child rushed forward, bearing a low stool. Navani pointed to the spot beside her, a spot only a few feet from the table. The child hesitated, but Navani pointed more insistently, and the child set the stool down. Navani sat gracefully, not sitting at the king's table, which was a masculine dining place, but certainly sitting near enough to be challenging protocol. The serving girl withdrew. At the end of the table, Elokar noticed his mother's actions but said nothing. One did not reprove Navani Kolin, not even if one were king.
Oh, sit down, Dalinar, she said, voice growing testy. We have matters of some moment to discuss.
Dalinar sighed but sat. The seats around them were still empty, and both the music and the hum of conversation on the island were loud enough to keep people from overhearing them. Some women had taken to playing flutes, music spreads spinning around them in the air.
You ask why I returned? Navani said, voice soft. Well, I have 3 reasons. First, I wanted to bring word that the Vadens have perfected their half-shards, as they call them. They're claiming the shields can stop blows from a shard blade.
Dalinar folded his arms before him on the table. He'd heard rumors of this, though he'd discounted them. Men were always claiming to be close to creating new shards, yet the promises were never fulfilled.
Have you seen one?
No, but I have confirmation from someone I trust.
She says they can only take the shape of a shield and don't lend any of Plate's other enhancements, but they can block a shard blade.
It was a step, a very small step, toward shard plate.
That was disturbing. He wouldn't believe it himself until he'd seen what these half-shards could do.
You could have sent this news via span read, Navani.
Well, I realized soon after reaching Kolinar that leaving here had been a political mistake. More and more these war camps are the true center of our kingdom.
Yes, Dalinar said quietly. Our absence from our homeland is dangerous. Hadn't that been the very argument that had convinced Navani to go home in the first place? The stately woman waved a dismissive hand.
I have determined that the Queen is sufficiently endowed with the requisite skills needed to hold Alethkar. There are schemes and plots. There will always be schemes and plots. But the truly important players inevitably make their way here.
Your son continues to see assassins around every corner, Dalinar said softly.
And shouldn't he, after what happened to his father?
True, but I fear he carries it to extremes. He mistrusts even his allies. Navani folded her hands in her lap, free hand lying atop safe hand.
He's not very good at this, is he?
Dalinar blinked in shock.
What?
Elikar is a good man. He has more integrity than any other light eyes in this army.
But his rule is weak, Navani said. You must admit that.
He is king, Dalinar said firmly, and my nephew. He is both my sword and my heart, Navani, and I will not hear ill spoken of him, even by his own mother.
She eyed him. Was she testing his loyalty? Much like her daughter, Navani was a political creature. Intrigue made her blossom like a rock bud in calm, wet air. However, unlike Yasna, Navani was hard to trust. At least with Yasna, one knew where one stood. Once again, Dalinar found himself wishing she'd put aside her projects and returned to the Shattered Plains.
I'm not speaking ill of my son, Dalinar, Navani said. We both know I am as loyal to him as you are. But I'd like to know what I'm working with, and that requires a definition. He is seen as weak, and I intend to see him protected, despite himself, if necessary.
Then we work for the same goals. But if protecting him was the second reason you returned, what was the third? She smiled a violet-eyed, red-lipped smile at him. A meaningful smile.
Blood of my ancestors, Dalinar thought. Storm winds, but she's beautiful. Beautiful and deadly.
It seemed a particular irony to him that his wife's face had been erased from his mind, and yet he could remember in complete and intricate detail the months this woman had spent toying with him and Gavilar. She'd played them off one another, fanning their desire before finally choosing the elder son. They'd all known the entire time that she would choose Gavilar. It had hurt anyway.
We need to talk sometime in private, Navani said. I want to hear your opinion on some of the things being said in camp.
That probably meant the rumors about him.
I'm very busy.
She rolled her eyes.
I'm sure you are. We're meeting anyway once I've had time to settle here and put out feelers. How about 1 week from today? I'll come read to you from that book of my husband's, and afterward we can chat. We'll do it in a public place, all right?
He sighed.
Very well, but...
High princes and light eyes, Elokar suddenly proclaimed.
Dalinar and Navani turned toward the end of the table where the king stood, wearing his uniform, complete with royal cape and crown. He raised a hand toward the island. The people hushed, and soon the only sound was that of the water burbling through the streams.
I'm sure many of you have heard the rumors regarding the attempt on my life during the hunt 3 days ago,
Elokar announced.
When my saddle girth was cut.
Dalinar glanced at Navani. She raised her free hand toward him and rocked it back and forth, indicating that she didn't find the rumors to be persuasive. She knew about the rumors, of course, Give Navani 5 minutes in a city and she'd know anything and everything of significance being gossiped about.
I assure you, I was never in real danger,
Elokar said.
Thanks, in part, to the protection of the King's Guard and the vigilance of my uncle. However, I believe it wise to treat all threats with due prudence and seriousness. Therefore, I am appointing Bright Lord Toral Sadius to be High Prince of Information, charging him to unearth the truth regarding this attempt on my life.
Dalinar blinked in shock. Then he closed his eyes and let out a soft groan.
Unearth the truth? Navani said skeptically. Sadius?
Blood of my... He thinks I'm ignoring the threats to him, so he's looking to Sadius instead.
Well, I suppose that's all right, she said. I kind of trust Sadius.
Navani, Dalinar said, opening his eyes. The incident happened on a hunt I planned under the protection of my guard and my soldiers. The king's horse was prepared by my grooms. He publicly asked me to look into this strap business, and now he's just taken the investigation away from me.
Oh, dear.
She understood. This was nearly the same thing as Elokar proclaiming that he suspected Dalinar. Any information Sadius unearthed regarding this assassination attempt could only reflect unfavorably on Dalinar. When Sadius's hatred of Dalinar and his love of Gavilar conflicted, which would win?
But the vision, it said to trust him.
Elokar sat back down, and the buzz of conversation resumed across the island at a higher pitch. The king seemed oblivious of what he had just done. Sadius was smiling broadly. He rose from his place, bidding farewell to the king, then began mingling.
You still argue he isn't a bad king?
Navani whispered.
My poor, distracted, oblivious boy.
Dalinar sat up, then walked down the table to where the king continued to eat. Elokar looked up.
Ah, Dalinar, I suspect you'll want to give Sadius your aid.
Dalinar sat down. Sadius's half-eaten meal still sat on the table, brass plate scattered with chunks of meat and torn flatbread.
Elokar, Dalinar forced out, I just spoke to you a few days ago. I asked to be High Prince of War and you said it was too dangerous.
It is, Elokar said. I spoke to Sadius about it and he agreed. The High Princes will never stand for someone being put over them in war. Sadius mentioned that if I started with something less threatening, like appointing someone to High Prince of Information, it might prepare the others for what you want to do.
Sadius suggested this, Dalinar said flatly.
Of course, Elokar said. It is time we had a High Prince of Information, and he specifically noted the cut girth as something he wanted to look into. He knows you've always said you aren't suited to these sorts of things.
Blood of my fathers, Dalinar thought, looking out at the center of the island where a group of light eyes gathered around Sadius. I've just been outmaneuvered. Brilliantly.
The High Prince of Information had authority over criminal investigations, particularly those of interest to the Crown. In a way, it was nearly as threatening as a High Prince of War, but it wouldn't seem so to Elokar. All he saw was that he would finally have someone willing to listen to his paranoid fears.
Sadius was a clever, clever man.
Don't look so morose, Uncle, Elokar said. I had no idea you'd want the position, and Sadius just seemed so excited at the idea. Perhaps he'll find nothing at all, and the leather was simply worn out. You'll be vindicated in always telling me that I'm not in as much danger as I think I am.
Vindicated?
Dalinar asked softly, still watching Sadius.
Somehow I doubt that is likely.
Many uses. You have accused me of arrogance in my quest. You have accused me of perpetuating my grudge against Race and Bavadin. Both accusations are true. Kaladin stood up in the wagon bed, scanning the landscape outside the camp as Rock and Teft put his plan, such as it was, into action.
Back home, the air had been drier. If you went about on the day before a high storm, everything seemed desolate. After storms, plants soon pulled back into their shells, trunks, and hiding places to conserve water. But here in the moister climate, they lingered. Many rock buds never quite pulled into their shells completely. Patches of grass were common. The trees Satius harvested were concentrated in a forest to the north of the war camps, but a few strays grew on this plain. They were enormous, broad-trunked things that grew with a westward slant, their thick, finger-like roots clawing into the stone and, over the years, cracking and breaking the ground around them. Kaladin hopped down from the cart. His job was to hoist up stones and place them on the bed of the vehicle. The other bridgemen brought them to him, laying them in heaps nearby. Bridgemen worked across the broad plain, moving among rock buds, patches of grass, and bunches of weeds that poked out from beneath boulders. Those grew most heavily on the west side, ready to pull back into their boulder's shadow if a high storm approached. It was a curious effect, as if each boulder were the head of an aged man with tufts of green and brown hair growing out from behind his ears. These tufts were extremely important, for hidden among them were thin reeds known as knobweed. Their rigid stalks were topped with delicate fronds that could retract into the stem. The stems themselves were immobile, but they were fairly safe growing behind boulders. Some would be pulled free in each storm, perhaps to attach themselves in a new location once the winds abated. Kaladin hoisted a rock, setting it on the bed of the wagon and rolling it beside some others. The rock's bottom was wet with lichen and creme. Knobweed wasn't rare, but neither was it as common as other weeds. A quick description had been enough to send Rock and Teft searching with some success. The breakthrough, however, had happened when Syl had joined the hunt. Kaladin glanced to the side as he stepped down for another stone. She zipped around, a faint, nearly invisible form leading Rock from one stand of reeds to another. Teft didn't understand how the large horn eater could consistently find so many more than he did, but Kaladin didn't feel inclined to explain. He still didn't understand why Rock could see Syl in the first place. The horn eater said it was something he'd been born with. A pair of bridgemen approached, youthful Dunny and earless Jax, towing a wooden sled bearing a large stone. Sweat trickled down the sides of their faces. As they reached the wagon, Kaladin dusted off his hands and helped them lift the boulder. Earless Jax scowled at him, muttering under his breath. "That's a nice one," Kaladin said, nodding to the stone. "Good work." Jax glared at him and stalked off. Dunny gave Kaladin a shrug, then hurried after the older man. As Rock had guessed, getting the crew assigned to stone-gathering duty had not helped Kaladin's popularity. But it had to be done. It was the only way to help Layton and the other wounded. Once Jax and Dunny left, Kaladin nonchalantly climbed into the wagon bed and knelt down, pushing aside a tarp and uncovering a large pile of knobweed stems. They were about as long as a man's forearm. He made as if he were moving stones around in the bed, but instead tied a large double handful of the reeds into a bundle, using thin rockbud vines. He dropped the bundle over the side of the wagon. The wagon driver had gone to chat with his counterpart on the other wagon. That left Kaladin alone, save for the chull that sat hunkered down in its rock shell, watching the sun with beady crustacean eyes. Kaladin hopped down from the wagon and placed another rock in the bed. Then he knelt as if to pull a large stone out from under the wagon. With deft hands, however, he tied the reeds into place underneath the bed right beside two other bundles. The wagon had a large open space to the side of the axle, and a wood dowel there provided an excellent place for mounting the bundles. "The Azera's ascend that nobody thinks to check the bottom as we roll back into camp." The apothecary said one drop came per stem. How many reeds would Kaladin need? He felt he knew the answer to that question without even giving it much thought. He'd need every drop he could get. He climbed out and lifted another stone into the wagon. Rock was approaching. The large tan-skinned horn eater carried an oblong stone that would have been too large for most of the bridgemen to handle alone. Rock shuffled forward slowly, Sills zipping around his head and occasionally landing on the rock to watch him. Kaladin climbed down and trotted across the uneven ground to help. Rock nodded in thanks. Together they hauled the stone to the wagon and set it down on the bed. Rock wiped his brow, turning his back to Kaladin. Sprouting from his pocket was a handful of reeds. Kaladin swiped them and tucked them beneath the tarp.
"What do we do if someone notices this thing we are doing?" Rock asked casually.
"Explain that I'm a weaver," Kaladin said, "and that I thought I'd weave myself a hat to keep off the sun." Rock snorted.
"I might just do that," Kaladin said.
He wiped his brow.
"It would be nice in this heat,
but best nobody sees. The mere fact that we want the reeds would probably be enough to make them deny them to us."
"This thing is true," Rock said, stretching and glancing upward as Syl zipped over in front of him. "I miss the peaks."
Syl pointed, and Rock bowed his head in reverence before following after her. Once she had him going in the right direction, however, she flitted back to Kaladin, bobbing up into the air as a ribbon, then falling down to the side of the wagon and reforming her womanly shape, her dress fluttering around her.
"I," she declared, raising a finger, "like him very much."
"Who, Rock?"
"Yes," she said, folding her arms. "He is respectful, unlike others."
"Fine," Kaladin said, lifting another stone into the wagon. "You can follow him around instead of bothering me." He tried not to show worry as he said it. He had grown accustomed to her company. She sniffed.
"I can't follow him. He's too respectful."
"You just said you liked that."
"I do. Also, I detest it."
She said that with unaffected frankness, as if oblivious of the contradiction. She sighed, sitting down on the side of the wagon.
"I led him to a patch of chul dung as a prank. He didn't even yell at me. He just looked at it as if trying to figure out some hidden meaning."
She grimaced.
"That's not normal."
"I think the Horn Eaters must worship Spren or something," Kaladin said, wiping his brow.
"That's silly."
"People believe much sillier things. In some ways, I guess it makes sense to revere the Spren. You are kind of odd and magical."
"I'm not odd," she said, standing up. "I'm beautiful and articulate."
She planted her hands on her hips, but he could see in her expression that she wasn't really mad. She seemed to be changing by the hour, growing more and more... More and more what? Not exactly human-like. More individual. Smarter. Syl fell silent as another bridgeman, Natum, approached. The long-faced man was carrying a smaller stone, obviously trying not to strain himself.
"Oh, Natum," Kaladin said, reaching down to take the stone. "How goes the work?"
Natum shrugged.
"Didn't you say you were once a farmer?"
Natum rested beside the wagon, ignoring Kaladin. Kaladin set down the rock, moving it into place.
"I'm sorry to make us work like this, but we need the goodwill of Gaz and the other bridge crews."
Natum didn't respond.
"It will help keep us alive," Kaladin said. "Trust me."
Natum just shrugged yet again, then wandered away. Kaladin sighed.
"This would be a lot easier if I could pin the duty change on Gaz."
"That wouldn't be very honest," Syl said, affronted.
"Why do you care so much about honesty?"
"I just do."
"Oh," Kaladin said, grunting as he moved back to his work. "And leading men to piles of dung? How honest is that?"
"That's different. It was a joke."
"I fail to see how..."
He trailed off as another bridgeman approached. Kaladin doubted anyone else had Rock's strange ability to see Syl and didn't want to be seen talking to himself. The short, wiry bridgeman had said his name was Scar, though Kaladin couldn't see any obvious scars on his face. He had short, dark hair and angular features. Kaladin tried to engage him in conversation, too, but got no response. The man even went so far as to give Kaladin a rude gesture before tromping back out.
I'm doing something wrong, Kaladin said, shaking his head and hopping down from the sturdy wagon.
Wrong?
Syl stepped up to the lip of the wagon, watching him. I thought that seeing me rescue those three might give them hope, but they're still indifferent.
Some watched you run earlier, Syl said, when you were practicing with the plank.
They watched, Kaladin said, but they don't care about helping the wounded. Nobody besides Rock, that is, and he's only doing it because he has a debt to me. Even Teft wasn't willing to share his food.
They're selfish.
No, I don't think that word can apply to them. He lifted a stone, struggling to explain how he felt. When I was a slave, well, I'm still a slave, but during the worst parts, when my masters were trying to beat out of me the ability to resist, I was like these men. I didn't care enough to be selfish. I was like an animal. I just did what I did without thinking. Syl frowned. Little wonder. Kaladin himself didn't understand what he was saying. Yet, as he spoke, he began to work out what he meant. I've shown them that we can survive, but that doesn't mean anything. If those lives aren't worth living, then they aren't ever going to care. It's like I'm offering them piles of spheres, but not giving them anything to spend their wealth on.
I guess, Syl said. But what can you do?
He looked back across the plain of rock, toward the war camp. The smoke of the army's many cook fires rose from the craters. I don't know. But I think we're going to need a lot more reeds. That night, Kaladin, Teft, and Rock walked the makeshift streets of Sadeus's war camp. Noman, the middle moon, shone with his pale blue-white light. Oil lanterns hung in front of buildings, indicating taverns or brothels. Spheres could provide more consistent, renewable light, but you could buy a bundle of candles or a pouch of oil for a single sphere. In the short run, it was often cheaper to do that, particularly if you were hanging your lights in a place that could be stolen. Sadeus didn't enforce a curfew, but Kaladin had learned that a lone bridgeman had best remain in the lumberyard at night. Half-drunken soldiers in stained uniforms sauntered past, whispering in the ears of whores or boasting to their friends. They called insults at the bridgeman, laughing riotously. The streets felt dark, even with the lanterns and the moonlight, and the haphazard nature of the camp, some stone structures, some wooden shanties, some tents, made it feel disorganized and dangerous. Kaladin and his two companions stepped aside for a large group of soldiers. Their coats were unbuttoned, and they were only mildly drunk. A soldier eyed the bridgeman, but the three of them together, one of them being a brawny horn-eater, were enough to dissuade the soldier from doing more than laughing and shoving Kaladin as he passed. The man smelled of sweat and cheap ale. Kaladin kept his temper. Fight back and he'd be docked pay for brawling.
I don't like this, Teft said, glancing over his shoulder at the group of soldiers. I'm going back to the camp.
You'll be staying, Rock growled.
Teft rolled his eyes.
You think I'm scared of a lumbering chull like you? I'll go if I want to, and...
Teft, Kaladin said softly. We need you.
Need.
That word had strange effects on men. Some ran when you used it. Others grew nervous. Teft seemed to long for it. He nodded, muttering to himself, but stayed with them as they went on. They soon reached the wagon yard. The fenced-off square of rock was near the western side of the camp. It was deserted for the night, the wagons sitting in long lines. Chulls lay slumbering in the nearby pen, looking like small hills. Kaladin crept forward, wary of sentries, but apparently nobody worried about something as large as a wagon being stolen from the middle of the army. Rock nudged him, then pointed to the shadowy chull pens. A lone boy sat upon a pen post, staring up at the moon. Chulls were valuable enough to watch over. Poor lad. How often was he required to wait up nights guarding the sluggish beasts? Kaladin crouched down beside a wagon, the other two mimicking him. He pointed down one row,
and Rock moved off. Kaladin pointed the other direction, and Teft rolled his eyes but did as asked. Kaladin sneaked down the middle row. There were about 30 wagons, 10 per row, but checking was quick. A brush of the fingers against the back plank, looking for the mark he'd made there. After just a few minutes, a shadowed figure entered Kaladin's row. Rock. The horn-eater gestured to the side and held up 5 fingers. 5th wagon from the top. Kaladin nodded and moved off. Just as he reached the indicated wagon, he heard a soft yelp from the direction Teft had gone. Kaladin flinched, then peeked up toward the sentry. The boy was still watching the moon, kicking his toes absently against the post next to him. A moment later, Rock and a sheepish Teft scurried up to Kaladin.
Sorry, Teft whispered. The walking mountain startled me. If I am being a mountain, Rock grumbled, then why weren't you hearing me coming, eh?
Kaladin snorted, feeling the back of the indicated wagon, fingers brushing the X mark in the wood. He took a breath, then climbed under the wagon on his back. The reeds were still there, tied in 20 bundles, each about as thick as a hand span.
Is she, herald of luck be praised, he whispered, untying the first bundle. All there, eh?
Teft said, leaning down, scratching at his beard in the moonlight.
Can't believe we found so many. Must have pulled up every reed on the entire plain.
Kaladin handed him the first bundle. Without Syl, they wouldn't have found a third this many. She had the speed of an insect in flight, and she seemed to have a sense of where to find things. Kaladin untied the next bundle, handing it out. Teft tied it to the other, making a larger bundle. As Kaladin worked, a flurry of small white leaves blew under the wagon and formed into Syl's figure. She slid to a stop beside his head.
No guards anywhere I could see. Just a boy in the chow pens.
Her white-blue translucent figure was nearly invisible in the darkness.
I hope these reeds are still good, Kaladin whispered. If they dried out too much.
They'll be fine. You worry like a worrier. I found you some bottles.
You did?
He asked, so eager that he nearly sat up. He caught himself before smacking his head. She nodded.
I'll show you. I couldn't carry them. Too solid.
Kaladin quickly untied the rest of the bundles, handing them out to the nervous Teft. Kaladin scooted out, then took 2 of the larger, tied-together bundles of 3. Teft took 2 of the others, and Rock managed 3 by tucking 1 under his arm. They'd need a place to work where they wouldn't be interrupted. Even if the knobweed seemed worthless, Gaz would find a way to ruin the work if he saw what was happening. Bottle first, Kaladin thought. He nodded to Syl, who led them out of the wagon yard into a tavern. It looked to have been hastily built from second-rate lumber, but that didn't stop the soldiers inside from enjoying themselves. Their rowdiness made Kaladin worry about the entire building collapsing. Behind it, in a splintery half-crate, lay a pile of discarded liquor bottles. Glass was precious enough that whole bottles would be reused, but these had cracks or broken tops. Kaladin set down his bundles, then selected 3 nearly whole bottles. He washed them in a nearby water barrel before tucking them into a sack he'd brought for the purpose. He picked up his bundles again, nodding to the others.
Try to look like you're doing something monotonous, he said. Bow your heads.
The other 2 nodded, and they walked out into a main road, carrying the bundles as if on some work detail. They drew far less attention than they had before. They avoided the lumberyard proper, crossing the open field of rock used as the army's staging area before walking down the slope of rock leading to the shattered plains. A sentry saw them, and Kaladin held his breath, but he said nothing. He probably assumed from their postures that they had a reason to be doing what they were. If they tried to leave the war camp, it would be a different story. But this section down near the first few chasms wasn't off limits. Before long, they approached the place where Kaladin had nearly killed himself. What a difference a few days could make. He felt like a different person, a strange hybrid of the man he had once been, the slave he'd become, and the pitiful wretch he still had to fight off. He remembered standing on the edge of the chasm, looking down. That darkness still terrified him.
If I fail to save the bridgeman, that wretch will take control again. This time he'll get his way.
That gave Kaladin a shiver. He set his bundles down beside the chasm ledge, then sat. The other two followed more hesitantly.
We're going to toss them into the chasm?
Teft asked, scratching his beard.
After all that work?
Of course not, Kaladin said.
He hesitated. Noman was bright, but it was still night.
You don't have any spheres, do you?
Why?
Teft asked, suspicious.
For light, Teft.
Teft grumbled, pulling out a handful of garnet chips.
I was going to spend these tonight, he said.
They glowed in his palm.
All right, Kaladin said, slipping out a reed. What did his father say about these?
Hesitantly, Kaladin broke off the furry top of the reed, exposing the hollow center. He took the reed by the other end and ran his finger down its length, squeezing it tight. Two drops of milky white liquid dripped into the empty liquor bottle. Kaladin smiled in satisfaction, then squeezed his fingers along the length again. Nothing came out this time, so he tossed the reed into the chasm. For all his talk of hats, he didn't want to leave evidence.
I thought you said we aren't throwing them in,
Teft accused. Kaladin held up the liquor bottle.
Only after we have this out.
What is it?
Rock leaned closer, squinting.
Knobweed sap. Or rather, knobweed milk. I don't think it's really sap. Anyway, it's a powerful antiseptic.
Anti-what?
Teft asked.
It scares away rotspren, Kaladin said. They cause infection. This milk is one of the best antiseptics there is. Spread it on a wound that's already infected, and it will still work.
That was good, because Leighton's wounds had begun to turn an angry red, rotspren crawling all over. Teft grunted, then glanced at the bundles.
There are a lot of reeds here.
I know, Kaladin said, handing over the other two bottles. That's why I'm glad I don't have to milk them all on my own.
Teft sighed, but sat down and untied a bundle. Rock did so without the complaining, sitting with his knees bent to the sides, feet pressed together to hold the bottle as he worked. A faint breeze blew up, rattling some of the reeds.
Why do you care about them?
Teft finally asked.
They're my men.
That's not what being bridge leader means.
It means whatever we decide, Kaladin said,
noting that Syl had come over to listen.
You, me, the others.
You think they'll let you do that?
Teft asked.
The Light Eyes and the captains?
You think they'll pay enough attention to even notice?
Teft hesitated, then grunted, milking another reed.
Perhaps they will, Rock said.
There was a surprising level of delicacy to the large man's motions as he milked the reeds. Kaladin hadn't thought those thick fingers would be so careful, so precise.
Light Eyes, they are often noticing those things that you wish they would not.
Teft grunted again, agreeing.
How did you come here, Rock? Kaladin asked. How does a horn-eater end up leaving his mountains and coming to the lowlands?
You shouldn't ask those kinds of things, son,
Teft said, wagging a finger at Kaladin.
We don't talk about our pasts.
We don't talk about anything, Kaladin said. You two didn't even know each other's names.
Names are one thing, Teft grumbled. Backgrounds. They're different.
Is all right, Rock said. I will speak of this thing.
Teft muttered to himself, but he did lean forward to listen when Rock spoke.
My people have no shard blades, Rock said in his low, rumbling voice.
That's not unusual, Kaladin said. Other than Alethkar and Yakaved, few kingdoms have many blades.
It was a matter of some pride among the armies.
This thing is not true, Rock said. Thelena has 5 blades and 3 full suits of plate, all held by the royal guards. The Salai have their share of both suits and blades. Other kingdoms, such as her days, have a single blade and set of plate. This is passed down through the royal line. But the Unkalaki, we have not a single shard. Many of our newer Toma, this thing, it is the same as your light eyes, only their eyes are not light.
How can you be a light eyes without light eyes?
Teft said with a scowl.
By having dark eyes, Rock said,
as if it were obvious.
We do not pick our leaders this way. It's complicated. But do not interrupt story.
He milked another reed, tossing the husk into a pile beside him.
The new Atoma, they see our lack of shards as great shame. They want these weapons very badly. It is believed that the new Atoma who first obtains a shard blade would become king, a thing we have not had for many years. No peak would fight another peak where a man held one of the blessed blades.
So you came to buy one? Kaladin asked. No shardbearer would sell his weapon. Each was a distinctive relic, taken from one of the Radiants after their betrayal. Rock laughed.
Ha! Buy? No. We are not so foolish as this. But my new Atoma, he knew of your tradition, eh? It says that if a man kills a shardbearer, he may take the blade and plate as his own. And so my new Atoma and his house, we made a grand procession, coming down to find and kill one of your shardbearers.
Kaladin almost laughed. I assume it proved more difficult than that.
My new Atoma was not a fool, Rock said, defensive. He knew this thing would be difficult. But your tradition, it gives us hope, you see. Occasionally, a brave new Atoma will come down to duel a shardbearer. Someday, one will win, and we will have shards.
Perhaps, Kaladin said, tossing an empty reed into the chasm. Assuming they agree to duel you in a bout to the death.
Oh, they always duel, Rock said, laughing. The new Atoma brings many riches and promises all of his possessions to the victor. Your light eyes, they cannot pass by a pond so warm. To kill a Unkalaki with no shard blade, they do not see this thing as difficult. Many new Atoma have died. But is all right. Eventually we will win.
And have one set of shards, Kaladin said. Alethkar has dozens.
One is a beginning, Rock said, shrugging. But my new Atoma lost. So I am Bridgeman.
Wait, Teft said. You came all this way with your Bright Lord, and once he lost, you up and joined a bridge crew?
No, no, you do not see, Rock said. My new Atoma, he challenged High Prince Sadius. It is well known that there are many shardbearers here on Shuttered Plains. My new Atoma thought it easier to fight man with only plate first, then win blade next.
And? Teft said.
Once my new Atoma lost to Bright Lord Sadius, all of us became his.
So you're a slave? Kaladin asked, reaching up and feeling the marks on his forehead.
No. We do not have this thing, Rock said. I was not a slave of my new Atoma. I was his family.
His family? Teft said. Kalak, you're a light eyes.
Rock laughed again, loud and full-bellied. Kaladin smiled despite himself. It seemed like so long since he'd heard someone laugh like that.
No, no. I was only Umartia. His cousin, you would say.
Still, you were related to him.
On the peaks, Rock said. The relatives of a Bright Lord are his servants.
What kind of system is that? Teft complained. You have to be a servant to your own relatives? Storm me, I'd rather die, I think I would.
It is not so bad, Rock said.
You don't know my relatives, Teft said, shivering.
Rock laughed again.
You would rather serve someone you do not know? Like this Sadius? A man who is no relation to you?
He shook his head.
Lowlanders, you have too much air here. Makes your mind sick.
Too much air? Kaladin asked.
Yes, Rock said.
How can you have too much air? It's all around.
This thing, it is difficult to explain.
Rock's Alethi was good, but he sometimes forgot to add in common words. Other times he remembered them, speaking his sentences precisely. The faster he spoke, the more words he forgot to put in.
You have too much air, Rock said. Come to the peaks. You will see.
I guess, Kaladin said, shooting a glance at Taft, who just shrugged. But you're wrong about one thing. You said that we serve someone we don't know. Well, I do know Bright Lord Sadeus. I know him well. Rock raised an eyebrow. Arrogant, Kaladin said. Vengeful, greedy, corrupt to the core. Rock smiled.
Yes, I think you are right. This man is not among the finest of Light Eyes.
There are no finest among them, Rock. They're all the same.
They have done much to you, then.
Kaladin shrugged, the question uncovering wounds that weren't yet healed. Anyway, your master was lucky.
Lucky to be slain by a shard-bearer?
Lucky he didn't win, Kaladin said, and discover how he'd been tricked. They wouldn't have let him walk away with Sadeus's plate.
Nonsense, Teft broke in. Tradition is the blind witness they use to condemn us, Teft, Kaladin said. It's the pretty box they use to wrap up their lies. It makes us serve them.
Teft set his jaw.
I've lived a lot longer than you, son. I know things. If a common man killed an enemy shard-bearer, he'd become a Light Eyes. That's the way of it.
He let the argument lapse. If Teft's illusions made him feel better about his place in this mess of a war, then who was Kaladin to dissuade him?
So you were a servant? Kaladin said to Rock. In a Bright Lord's retinue?
What kind of servant? He struggled for the right word, remembering back to the times he'd interacted with Wistio or Roshon.
A footman? A butler?
Rock laughed.
I was cook. My new Atoma would not come down to the lowlands without his own cook. Your food here, it has so many spices that you cannot taste anything else. Might as well be eating stones powdered with pepper.
You should talk about food, Teft said, scowling. A horn eater?
Kaladin frowned. Why do they call your people that anyway?
Because they eat the horns and shells of the things they catch, Teft said. The outsides.
Rock smiled with a look of longing.
Ah,
but the taste is so good.
You actually eat the shells? Kaladin asked.
We have very strong teeth, Rock said proudly. But there, you now know my story. Bright Lord Sadeus, he wasn't certain what he should do with most of us. Some were made soldiers, others serve in his household. I fixed him one meal and he sent me to Bridge Cruise.
Rock hesitated.
I may have, enhanced the soup.
Enhanced? Kaladin asked, raising an eyebrow. Rock seemed to grow embarrassed.
You see, I was quite angry about my new Atoma's death. And I thought these lowlanders, their tongues are all scorched and burned by the food they eat. They have no taste and...
And what? Kaladin asked.
Chuldung, Rock said. It apparently has stronger taste than I assumed.
Wait, Teft said. You put chuldung in High Prince Sadeus's soup?
Yes, Rock said. Actually, I put this thing in his bread, too, and used it as a garnish on the pork steak, and made a chutney out of it for the buttered garums. Chuldung, it has many uses, I found.
Teft laughed, his voice echoing. He fell on his side, so amused that Kaladin was afraid he'd roll right into the chasm.
Ornator, Teft finally said. I owe you a drink.
Rock smiled. Kaladin shook his head to himself, amazed.
It suddenly made sense.
What?
Rock said, apparently noticing his expression.
This is what we need, Kaladin said. This. It's the thing I've been missing.
Rock hesitated.
Chuldung? This is the thing you need?
Teft burst into another round of laughter.
No, Kaladin said. It's... Well, I'll show you. But first we need this knobweed sap.
They'd barely made their way through one of the bundles, and already his fingers were aching from the milking.
What of you, Kaladin?
Rock asked.
I have been telling you my story. You will tell me yours? How did you come to those marks on your forehead?
Yeah, Teft said, wiping his eyes. What food did you trad in?
I thought you said it was taboo to ask about a bridgeman's past, Kaladin said.
You made Rock share, son, Teft said. It's only fair.
So if I tell you my story, that means you'll tell yours? Teft scowled immediately.
Now look, I ain't going to...
I killed a man, Kaladin said. That quieted Teft. Rock perked up. Sill, Kaladin noticed, was still watching with interest. That was odd for her. Normally her attention wavered quickly.
You killed a man, Rock said. And after this thing they made you a slave? Is not the punishment for murder usually death?
It wasn't murder, Kaladin said softly, thinking of the scraggly bearded man in the slave wagon who had asked him these same questions. In fact, I was thanked for it by someone very important.
He fell silent.
And? Teft finally asked.
And, Kaladin said, looking down at a reed. Noman was setting in the west, and the small green disk of Meshim, the final moon, was rising in the east.